Today's Teisho will be on case three in the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case three is entitled Basso's Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Engo's introduction. Each key and every kyo, every word and phrase is a means for the moment of leading students to realization. But every such manipulation is like performing an operation on a healthy body and will give rise to complication after complication. The great way manifests itself naturally. It is limited by no fixed rules. But I must tell you that there is an advanced theme that you will have to learn. It presides over heaven and earth. However, if you try to guess at it, you will be confused. This can be right, and that can also be right. It is so delicate. This cannot be right, and this also cannot be right. An unapproachable cliff face. How could you manage without stumbling here or there? See the following main subject. The great master Basso was seriously ill. The chief priests of the temple came to pay his respects. He said, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Secho's verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors. For 20 years, I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks don't make light of it. So thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen this morning and for doing such a wonderful job, for sitting so well for, in many cases, for many hours. It's really how it's done. That's really excellent. So when I was driving here today, I was listening to an NPR radio show from which I get many ideas for Teishos. And the host of this particular program, a woman named Maiken Scott, the theme of that particular program was happiness. And she was interviewing various experts on happiness and talking to them about what kind of a life makes for happiness. And I'll get back to her program in a little bit. But, as soon as I heard her talking about happiness, I immediately thought of Buddhism, partly because I think about Buddhism a lot, but also because Buddhism is so closely associated in the popular imagination, in the press and in the popular in magazines and newspapers, with happiness, right? The Dalai Lama has a book on happiness, and it shows his beaming face on the cover, his smiling face. Often when the Dalai Lama is photographed, he has a big smile on his face. And this is typical of a lot of Buddhist literature. There's a big smiling person on the cover. And I think the Dalai Lama's book is called something like The Art of Happiness, right? And a number of weeks ago, there was an interview with a French monk in the Tibetan tradition. And he is somebody I respect quite a bit. He's written a number of books, including some very good books on animal rights. And he is routinely, his name is Matthieu Ricard. And Matthieu Ricard is somebody who's trained very well, very extensively in the Tibetan tradition. And he's, I think, probably in his 70s now, or maybe even a little older. He came to fame in the world about 30 years ago as, quote, the happiest man in the world. When he put out his first book, there was this PR blitz, and they were selling Matthieu Ricard as this the happiest man in the world, you know. And have done studies, social scientists have done studies of happiness, and they find that Matthieu Ricard and a few other Tibetan monks are off the charts, right? You know, off the charts. So, I was thinking about this program, Happiness. I was thinking about Matthieu Ricard. And I was thinking about Buddhism's close association with happiness. And I have to say this worries me quite a bit. You know, I'm worried that Buddhism, in order to make inroads with Western people, Buddhism is a foreign tradition. It comes from India and then went to East Asia. The Buddhism we practice, Zen, has many Chinese characteristics. Matthieu Ricard studied in a different tradition of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. So Buddhism left India and it went to East Asia, it went to North Asia. It went to Persia, as a matter of fact. Until Islam, there were half of Iran was a Buddhist country. So basically, when Buddhism has come here to the West and to the United States, it makes sense that it would try to communicate in the language of the host culture, right? So it makes sense, you know, that the Buddhism would present itself in using Western ideas as sort of like a bridge into Buddhism. And this is actually essential. People wouldn't understand it at all if teachers and scholars didn't build these bridges. So Buddhism made some sense to people, right? I mean, I remember when I was in my teenage years, I got very interested in different religions, right? And I went to a couple of different synagogues and a couple of different churches. I went to a Catholic church. I went to a Presbyterian church. Wherever I had friends, I would go to, you know, for a service with them. And I was reading about religion, and I remember reading this article, this very brief discussion of Buddhism, and it said, Buddhists worship the void, right? And it was like, oh, no thanks, you know, I definitely, that doesn't sound, who would be a Buddhist? You know, they believe in nothingness, they worship the void, right? It's like, oh, so count me out on that one. So luckily, you know, all of these very talented people for almost 100 years now have been trying to communicate concept like emptiness to Westerners. And it's not easy, right? Because we have, you know, for most people in the West, emptiness is really menacing, or nothingness. You say, my life is just nothing. My life is nothing. I've got nothing to show, you know. There was a famous Western philosopher who said, something, whatever it is always better than nothing. So we have like this phobia about nothing. It's taken a long time for Americans to understand that nothingness or emptiness might not be such a bad thing, right? So we owe all of these people a lot of thanks. And we also, I'm kind of glad that there are these books on Buddhism and happiness and all the photographs of the laughing Dalai Lama. But you know, actually, if you go to look at early Buddhist sutras, happiness is very rarely referred to. It's very rarely. It doesn't turn. I've yet to find it in the in the I've yet to find it very often in the early Buddhist the suttas, the Pali texts, you know. I worry that we're making Buddhism into something that it's not. You know, we're making Buddhism into something that it's not, and we're making it something that we can hold on to because it's familiar. And at the same time, you know, we're losing the depth, or we're losing something which is really much more important. So, you know, happiness is just like this huge industry. There's actually like a happiness industrial complex, right? And in psychology, there's a whole this whole movement in psychology called positive psychology. And the idea is that in the old days, people like Freud or Jung or early psychologists studied people who had mental problems like depression or neurosis. Like Freud was really interested in neurosis, right? And Freud dealt, of course, with patients, people who were having dysfunctions of various kinds, you know, basically people who were hysterical or who were out of control, were brought to Freud or came to Freud, people who had overwhelming compulsive behaviors, people who lit things on fire. So early psychology was interested in abnormal psychology, right? And in the modern world, there's this whole emphasis on positive psychology. Instead of studying people who have problems, and we all have problems, right? But instead of studying just that, let's look at healthy people. And so there's this whole industry now of, you know, happiness studies and the art of happiness. People want to teach the art of happiness in schools and things like that. And, you know, this worries me because I feel, first of all, that it's all going to fall apart. You know, already a lot of these happiness studies have been shown not to be true. There have been a number of, there were some very famous happiness studies that made all these claims. And then this graduate student looked at the statistical analysis and he found all of these problems, you know, the claims were not. Actually, what he showed were the data sets couldn't be real, that they'd been fudged on this very famous book, very famous study. So you know, I'm a little bit worried about that, but also I'm a little bit worried about people's obsession with happiness, you know. I mean, I myself like to be happy sometimes, but I've been doing Zazen for almost 50 years. I'm not happy all the time. I'm not. Maybe this will empty the room out. Everybody will leave now, right? But you know, I'm sure you can remember when you were a little kid and you were doing something you really loved, right? It's like, you know, the last day of school is such an interesting day, right? When you were a kid, right? Because it's like school is going to end. You don't have to get up. You don't have to get on the school bus. You don't have to do your homework. You know, you don't have this highly structured day. You don't spend your afternoon hours wishing you were outside playing while your teacher drones on, right? Suddenly you're going to be released into freedom. And it's just, it's a moment of so much promise, right? And then you're out of school. And maybe it's different now, but, you know, the first couple of weeks were really sweet, and then it's sort of like boring. It's like, now what do I do, right? You know. So suddenly, you know, those first couple of days, God, I don't have to get up. I don't have to go to school. I can just lie in bed. I can read. But, you know, a week later, it's like, or a couple of weeks later, it's like, you know, or, you know, I'd go in and my mother would say, what's wrong with you? Don't you have anything to do? And I'd say, no, I don't have anything to do, you know. So I took up reading, right? And that helped me. But what seemed so wonderful and so promising, when I repeated it a couple times, lost all of its flavor, right? And maybe you've had this experience too, where, you know, as you're a kid and maybe you like you know, something like a chocolate cake, right? Or when I was a kid, I loved chocolate cherries. I don't know if you know what chocolate cherries are. They're not that popular anymore, but they're these maraschino cherries that are enclosed in milk chocolate. And, you know, they're super gooey and sweet and cloyingly sweet. But as a kid, I just thought this was heaven, right? And I, you know, I would have one of these cherry chocolate. What would you like as a treat? A cherry chocolate, please. You know, my mother would give me a couple of cherry. And I remember getting a box of cherry chocolates and literally eating myself into, like, I have never had them again, right? It's like that first cherry chocolate, delicious. The second cherry chocolate, less delicious. You know, the 20th cherry chocolate, it's like you want to throw up. So there's something slightly childish, actually, like childish, right, about wanting to be happy all the time. You know, that's unrealistic, but it's also, you know, it's impossible, I would say, to sustain any mental state, right? It's impossible. So, you know, when you're happy, it's great, you know, you're wonderful. But, you know, it's not going to last. And in fact, one of the fundamental teachings is of Buddhism is it's not going to last. You know, enjoy it now because it's not going to last. You know, expecting happiness to be a lasting state shows you haven't really sort of paid attention to some fundamental Buddhist teachings, right? And clinging to happiness is a big problem, right? You know, this is going to sound wanting to have happiness a lot in your life is actually a kind of possessiveness or grasping, you know? So, possessiveness or grasping is considered in Buddhism a sort of like obstacle to waking up, right? It's like, you know, if you have a good day, one way to enjoy that day is to just say, this is happening now, and how wonderful it is that I'm having this great morning. You know, I got up, low humidity, I went outside, I went for a run, you know, I bettered my time today, you know, for a change. I had a cappuccino, you know, all good, right? Then you could say, this was a wonderful morning. And then, you know, in the afternoon, some problems arise, right? As they always do, you know, it's unsustained. You can't stay in that morning forever. So in the afternoon, you know, you go out to your car and you see you have a flat tire. And then you have to call your friend and say, listen, I'm going to be late. And you go into your trunk. And you realize that the jack isn't there. You gave the jack to Eddie, your neighbor, and he never returned it. And then you have to get go get the jack. And then, you know, there's some other problems, right? You know, and it's like the problems build up and you could say, oh, I had that moment of happiness and it's gone, right? And that's inevitably the case, right? I have so many friends who are about 10 years older than I am. And, you know, they're all basically sort of falling apart. And, you know, it's not possible to be young forever, right? It's not, you know, you can take antioxidants, but, you know, basically no state, no condition of existence can be permanent or recur forever. Right? It's just not going to happen. Everybody's going to get old. The smartest people in the world, you know, their brains get old, you know. And trying to hold on to that happy morning is actually very counterproductive, right? It's like, you know, if you have that happy morning and then, you know, you have a flat tire and you have to get a jack out of the jack is missing and, you know, one way to deal with those events is to go, oh, damn, you know, I had such a happy morning, and now I'm in the crap. You know, it's the usual bullshit, right? And you get angry, frustrated. And in a certain way, that's like anti-Zen, right? That's like anti-Zen, right? You know, one way to deal with the situation is to say, this is what is happening now. This is the universe right now. So I'm going to respond to the universe right now. You know, I'm going to watch my breath. I'm going to ground my mind in samadhi, in dispassionate awareness, right? Choiceless, dispassionate awareness. And so, you know, the flat tire is only a big problem because you're making it a big problem. It's in the nature of all tires to be punctured and to go flat, right? Statistically, most of them are going to go flat. You know, so a flat tire isn't good or bad, you make it good or bad. And you know, if you embrace this moment, you know, if you go into samadhi and you say, this moment is who and what I am right now. You know, this is the universe right now for me, you know, you find yourself responding to the situation with a lot of energy and even joy. You know, joy is not the same thing as happiness. I want to say a little bit more about that. But the thing is, you know, clinging to a prior state, right? Clinging to a prior state is childish. That's like the kid who wants to, I want to eat chocolate cake every day, right? And the thing is that chocolate cake every day is sickening, right? And we may idealize that morning as the perfect morning, and we may despise the afternoon. But actually, we're not. That prevents us from being fully present in what's happening now, right? And being fully present means entering this dispassionate state, right? This choiceless awareness. Awareness of pure presentness. And this is what we train to do on the cushion. This is what, you know, a lot of Zen training is about, learning how to find that state and learning how to rest serenely in that state. You know, so people who start Zen learn how to watch their breath, they learn how to enter samadhi, and if you're working on a koan, you know, the good day when you're working on a koan is when you go in to see your teacher and the teacher says, my God, that's a fantastic answer. Well done. And, you know, if you hold on to that, you know, basically, you know, you're setting yourself up for very miserable practice subsequently, right? So, you know, if you say, oh, I want that to happen again, you know, it may never happen again. You know, the next time you're working on a koan, you may find yourself so blocked, you know, you may just find yourself wanting to throw a chair through a window sometime. And you might say, oh, if only I were back with the other koan. The way to deal with failure is to embrace failure, you know, failure. Success, failure and success, you know, when we make something a success, we make something a failure, right? And when we cling to success and we are afraid of failure, we've created this enormous obstacle. You know, there is really no such thing as success. There really is no such thing as failure. There's just an endless series of transient states. And we can assign them a value or not, right? We can assign them a positive value. We can assign them a negative value. But, you know, the art of, you could say, the art of Zen is to be with them 100%, okay? So one way to understand this koan is that it's about this choiceless awareness, right? Choiceless awareness. The happiness industrial complex encourages people to cultivate a grasping mentality, right? Grasping, seeking and grasping, right? And of course, this ties in with all kinds of other aspects of our culture. You know, our culture is based upon seeking and grasping and holding, right? I mean, basically our culture's wants people to be possessive individualists, and it wants people to feel deprived if they're not acquiring something. So all of these people who maybe are unhappy with their lives, you know, they see the interview with Mathieu Ricard, and it says he's the happiest man in the world, and they think, okay, maybe I should take up Buddhism because I too will be as happy as Mathieu Ricard. And, you know, as I say, I think happiness is a wonderful thing, but, you know, now it's become a commodity, right? It's become something you pursue and acquire and hold on to, right? Another example of this is like the bucket list in travel literature. I don't know if you know about the bucket list, but every once in a while, some magazine will come up with the 50 places or the 100 places you have to see before you die, right? It's like, if you don't start checking those off, you've had an impoverished life, right? You know, this is the same mentality that drives like the happiness industrial complex. You know, I've definitely known people who aren't world travelers who have really rich and wonderful lives. My Dharma grandfather, my Webb's teacher, was a Japanese monk named Miyauchi Kanko. And Miyauchi Kanko had no personal property. He had, like any monk in a Buddhist tradition, he had two robes. He had a winter robe and a summer robe, right? He didn't have a posturepedic mattress. He had a tatami that belonged to the temple. That's what they covered the floors with. And he had like a futon. You know, in America, futons are these big mattress-like affairs, but in Japan, a futon is just like a quilt. It's a little bit more padded than a quilt. So, you know, he had a winter robe and a summer robe, and he slept on a tatami mat with his quilt, you could say. He had a razor for shaving his head. He had a begging bowl. And, you know, he had a few other personal items, right? But that was it. He didn't travel much in his life, right? He pretty much lived in a very narrow orbit near the city of Kyoto, right? In the outskirts of Kyoto. And that was his life. And, you know, Miyauchi San was, you know, deeply awakened person. You know, I would say powerfully awakened person who had worked through barrier after barrier and was deeply connected with everything around him. Now, I don't know if you've ever read the book Thoreau's book Walden, but Walden is one of my favorite books, you know, and, you know, Thoreau deliberately refused to participate in his society. He went out and lived by this lake, right, this little pond. He built a house with materials that were easily purchased, you know, like scrap wood. He built this little shack out in the woods. And, you know, Thoreau's, his book is considered like this masterpiece, and I certainly think it is. And, you know, he's living in a very small world. And, you know, as he lives there, the world gets larger and larger. You know, he brings his attention to things that we would walk by unthinkingly. And, you know, things like the pond freezing over become like this amazing thing to him. He measures the ice. He has this sort of fantasy, you could say, that the pond, Walden Pond, the water in Walden Pond is connected under the ground to all these other ponds in the world, right? And, you know, it's kind of a fantasy, but it's also kind of true, right? It's like the small particular world that he lived in, the more carefully he looked at it, the more fully he embraced it, the larger it became until it became the whole world, right? I mean, maybe someday people will say of us, oh, those poor humans in the 21st century, they only knew life on one planet. You know, they never got to go to all the different constellations in their starships. You know, what a miserable lives they must have lived, right? And but it's existence is really not like that, right? I mean, great and small, you know, are really relative terms, right? I mean, if you never go more than 5 miles, if your life is bounded by 5 miles on each side, you know, if you live deeply and attentively, you know, it's as though you that becomes it becomes universal, right? Becomes, I mean, that's sort of the theme of the book. Thoreau was saying, look, you know, when you live for whatever, happiness or success, you know, you wind up living a life of what he called quiet desperation, right? Quiet desperation. It's because you're always grasping for something you don't have, right? So, you know, happiness too becomes something we grasp for, we want all the time, right? But of course, that makes happiness impossible to achieve, but it also places us in this position of constantly reaching, constantly dissatisfied with where we are. You know, so that there's a kind of person who would be miserable at Walden Pond because he, you know, and they kind of got into this on the program I was listening to. They were one of the things that they were talking about was life decisions. And one of the life decisions they were talking about was whether or not whether or not to have children, right? That was one of the topics. And the question was, do people who have children have more happiness than people who don't have children? And, you know, the standard belief is that if you have children, you will be happier than people who don't have children. And, you know, lots of social scientists have investigated this, assuming it was true, and found it isn't true. You know, they find that people who don't have children are just as happy or unhappy as people who have children, right? But the interesting part of the program was they were talking about people who don't have children and the ones who are unhappy. And it was interesting because so many of those people said, you know, I just felt that there was a road I did not go down. And I regret, these are the people without children. They said, you know, there's a road I did not go down having children. And even though I'm pretty happy, I deeply regret not going down that road. So then they interviewed people who have children who are unhappy. And it was interesting because there was a woman they interviewed who was very clear. She said, I love my child, but I really am sorry I had children. Right? And she was she was so nice. She wasn't a mean person. She wasn't a monster. She was a really nice person. I'm sure she was a good mother because she could be honest about this, right? And she said, you know, she said, I'm glad. She said, I love my child, but, you know, when I had a child, I had no idea how demanding it would be and how much time it would take. And she said, you know, ultimately, I regret not taking the other road, right? So it's like, okay, the one with no child regrets not taking the other road. The one with a child regrets not taking the other road, right? You know, so I think that's very human, right? But it's a grasping mentality, right? You know, when I was in graduate school, I so wanted a job. I had spent 8 years writing this stupid dissertation. And I was on the job market and I couldn't get a job. I kept going to these interviews and people were saying, oh, you're a nice young man, you're nice, but I'm sorry, but we don't have a job for you, right? We're giving it to somebody else. And I finally just thought, if I could only get a job, everything would be fine. That wasn't true. But I did get a job, and that did solve some problems, right? But, you know, it's possible when you come to a place like Rutgers to stay there and say, you know, Rutgers is okay, but I could be somewhere else. You know, I could be in California right now, right? And, you know, and in other words, whatever happens to you, it's always, there's always a road not taken, right? There's always a road not taken, and craving the road not taken is something we do all the time, right? I live in Plainfield, but oh, if only I lived along the Delaware River in Lambertville, you know, my life would be so much better. And we tend to think that way, right? You know, we all do at certain times. So if only I had done this, my life would be so much better. Maybe it would. But the real problem is the mentality, right, of constantly reaching for something other than this moment, this moment. Right. So you know, in happiness studies, you know, it's nice to know a little bit about happiness. I think most of us are able to be happy some of the time. And I think that the cult of happiness sort of is promising us something that isn't very good for us. It's like getting chocolate cake every morning for breakfast, right? It's like sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're not happy. And, you know, I think the problem arises when you cling to, when you dread either state or you cling to either state. A life dedicated to pursuing happiness, it seems to me, is a narcissistic life, right? A life dedicated to suffering is also kind of narcissistic, right? It's like what things arise as they arise, right? Things arise as they arise. And there's a way in which you're not passing judgment on what arises. You're simply being present with it, right? You're simply being present with it. At this moment, this is my universe. You know, at this moment, this is 100% of everything that exists. You know, actually, it's a fantasy to think this moment could be different than it is. Every moment has to be just the moment that it is. It couldn't be any other moment. Right? So how we recognize the moment, you know, is the most important thing. And, you know, it's not realistic, it's not wise, it's not wisdom to expect to be happy all the time. It's not healthy to expect to be unhappy all the time. If you're unhappy all the time, you need to work on that, right? But, you know, interestingly, I think one way to avoid being unhappy is to stop being judgmental about what's happening. You know, one way to stop being unhappy is to say, I am so grateful for this moment, whatever it might be. I'm so grateful for this moment. And every once in a while, that actually happens to us, right? You know, there's the flat tire, you're on the Garden State Parkway, you have a flat tire, you go to call and you're out of charge on your phone, right? And you want to throw the phone into the bushes and scream. But you know, every once in a while it hits us, you know, life is so beautiful. Just this moment is everything, is so precious. I am so grateful for just this moment, right? Just this moment. And I think people have, they get closer to this, right, when they do have misfortune. You know, I've talked a little bit about, you know, about people I know who have died or people I know who have been in difficult situations. You know, the last day of my father's life, you know, basically he had, like, I would say he had a kind of great simplicity. You know, he was not a happy person, very much discontent all the time with his life. Always felt that he hadn't managed to achieve what he should have achieved and was haunted by that. And, you know, at the end of his life, you know, I was with him on the last day of his life. And you know, I said, is there anything I can do? You know, because he had cancer and his lungs were filling up with fluid. and my sister was giving him morphine drip so he didn't have a panic reaction to drowning, basically. I said, "Can I do anything for you?" He said, "I'd like some chicken soup," which is something he ate as a little boy, right? So I went into the kitchen and there was like Progresso chicken soup, right? And I heated it up and I brought it in a bowl I gave him like 3 spoonfuls, right? And he said, "Oh, that is so delicious," right? So delicious. See, I think that's being present in the moment, you know, without judgment, you know. How many bowls of chicken soup did he not enjoy because he wanted to be someone else or somewhere else, right? And, you know, giving up on the aspiration to anything other than what is here now was a kind of liberation for him, right? At this moment, it was like finding the secret at the end of his life, you know, just gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. You know, in Zen we talk about just this. You know, we bring to the moment all these expectations. We take from the moment, you know, further expectations. But sometimes we're able to just be present without judgment, to become one with what is happening. And when we become one with what is happening, you know, it's not sadness and it's not happiness, it's joy, right? It's joy. Joy, I think, is different from happiness. You know, I think what joy does is it lifts us out of ourselves and it connects us to something greater than ourselves, right? This bigger life. And I actually think, my personal feeling is that people who live for happiness, you know, don't often have joy, actually. Because, you know, happiness tends to be the pursuit of happiness, even though it's guaranteed in our national treasures, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, basically that's kind of a self-centered, I'm not saying you shouldn't be happy, but I'm saying it's a kind of self-directed aspiration. And to wish happiness for others is better, but you know to get beyond judgment and to be present with just this, that's the beginning of wisdom. Right? So this koan is, you know, basically, basso is matsu, and he's really so important for Zen. He, in many ways, real Zen begins with Ma Tzu, like Lao Tzu, Ma Tzu. My pronunciation is terrible, but it says like ancestor, right? Elder, ancestor. So Lao Tzu is the author of the Tao Te Ching, right? But Ma Tzu is like the horse. Ancestor horse, Ma, is a horse. That was his Dharma name, right? So he really was a genius, like Wei Neng, right? Just this great genius. And he's dying, right? He's an enlightened person, but everybody dies. Everybody, you know, the organs fail. The great master horse ancestor was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He said, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha." Right. So it's like, you know, some days you're born and some days you die. You know, some days you get a promotion, some days you don't get a promotion. Some days you have a kid and some days you don't have a kid. You know, some days you get married and some days you never get married. Right. But, you know, none of these conditions last, right? None of these conditions last, and holding on to any of them is going to produce suffering, right? And letting any of them go is the release from suffering, right? But there's even a little more to this koan, right? You know, if you keep practicing Zen, if you keep practicing, you know, if you keep practicing Zen, you have this experience where, you know, there's this moment, and then there's another moment, and then there's another moment. And in this moment, you know, it's lunchtime and you get to eat. And in the next moment, it's after lunch and you're feeling sleepy. And in the next moment, you've had some tea and you feel better and you hear a bird outside. And in the next moment, see, it's like there's this moment and this moment and there's this moment and there's this moment. The moments come and go and come and go. And a lot of Zen practice is just sitting on the cushion and watching the moments come and go. And if you cling to any moment, you cause yourself suffering. And if you let the moments come and go and flow freely without judgment, you feel joy sometimes. But also, you know, you begin to notice that there's something always there in every moment, and in not only in each moment, but in all moments. I don't know if this is making any sense. But in every moment, there's something there that's always there. So, you know, it's there whether you're happy or sad. It's there whether you're being born or you're dying. It's there whether you're bored or engaged, and so on and so on. There's something there no matter what. It's like the blue sky behind the passing clouds, see? So this cloud is bright and puffy, and this cloud is dark and menacing. And this cloud is high and thin, and this cloud is low and, you know, dropping rain. But behind all of these clouds is blue sky, right? There's this blue sky, you know, which is big, we say in Zen, big mind, right? So it's very important to greet every moment with dispassionate attention, right? And they come and they go. And if you let them come and go, you know, you feel a kind of freedom and real joy. But there's something behind, there's something present in all of these moments. It takes a lot of sitting to begin to become aware of it. But when you become aware of it, once you become aware of it, you realize it's always there, right? See, so there's a sun-faced Buddha and there's a moon-faced Buddha, but there's something that's always there. So please keep looking for that something which is always there. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. Engo's introduction. Each key and kyo, every word and phrase, is a means for the moment of leading students to realization. But every such manipulation, so key is in, it's like chi, right? Key is like energy, and kyo is the release of energy. So one way to think about Zen practice is it involves building up energy and then releasing energy, right? It's not how we normally talk about it, but if you draw a bowstring, that's ki, building up energy. If you release the bowstring and the arrow flies to the target, that's kyo. So when you're trying to answer your koan, you sit hard and you build up a lot of energy and finally you break through. So it's like working on your koan is like drawing the string, and letting the arrow fly to the target is like having a breakthrough and freeing yourself from your obstacle. Each key and every kyo, every word and phrase, is just a means for the moment of leading students to realization. But every such manipulation is like performing an operation on a healthy body and will give rise to complication upon complication. The great way manifests itself naturally. You know, you can be promoted or not promoted. You can be born or you can die. But there's something that's always the same, right? There's something that doesn't change. The great way manifests itself naturally. It is limited by no fixed rules, but I must tell you that there is an advanced theme you have to learn. It presides over heaven and earth. However, if you try to guess at it, you will be confused. This can be right, and that can also be right. It is so delicate. This can be right, and that this cannot be right, and that also cannot be right. An unapproachable cliff face. How will you manage without stumbling here or there? Study the following. The great master ancestor horse was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He said, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha." Setro's verse, "Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha, compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors, the great ancestors are pale besides these two. For 20 years, I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks don't make light of it.